This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Broadband Over Powerline World. We're about to speak with Bob Shipton, who's the vice president of the Verde Valley Amateur Radio Association in Arizona. Welcome to Broadband Over Powerline World.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Why don't you tell listeners who don't know where exactly Cottonwood, Arizona is?
Okay, Cottonwood is in north-central Arizona, about 90 miles north of Phoenix and about 50 miles south of Flagstaff. If you've seen any John Wayne movies, we're near Sedona, Arizona, so you know what that looks like.
All right, and how big a place is Cottonwood?
Cottonwood's about 6,000 people.
Okay, and how many amateur radio operators would you say are there?
Well, there's 800 hams in Yavapai County and probably in the Verde Valley here, probably a couple hundred ham operators.
Okay, now, when did you first find out that there was going to be a broadband over power line trial there in Cottonwood?
That was last January.
January 2004?
Yes.
Okay, and where did you find out about it? How did you find out about it?
Well, we found out about it from the American Radio Relay League, who had put out a bulletin that Cottonwood was to be a trial test city for broadband over power line.
Okay, and as far as you know, who all is running that trial?
Well, there was a company that's running it out of Nyack, New York, Electric Broadband Company, and then Mountain Telecommunications is one of the people involved, and then Arizona Public Service, the state utility.
Okay, I was setting up to talk to you. I got a voicemail from a spokesperson from APS who said that they have no intention of going into the broadband over power line business themselves, but they're open to other people using the line to do it. Is that your understanding as well?
That's my understanding, that APS would be the wholesaler to whoever the provider would be for the broadband signals.
Okay, and do you know who has whatever licenses were ever issued by the FCC to run the trial?
Well, Electric Broadband holds the experimental license.
Okay, so have you been in touch with them? Were you in touch with them before they began the trial?
Oh, yes. We were in contact with them last February on the phone, and then we met face-to-face at one of the APS offices. I believe it was sometime in May.
Okay, and what was the nature of the exchange of communication between you and those individuals?
Well, they were very open, and they gave us a tour of the trial site, showing us where the various nodes were and the architecture of the system.
How big a deployment is it? How many nodes are there?
I believe there's two trial sites. I think there's eight nodes total within that trial site, and they're both overhead power lines and underground power lines. One of the sites involves a private academy with about 44 computers inside of it.
Right.
And there's one apartment complex, I think, that has three users, and another small patio home complex that has three users as part of this beta test.
Okay. And when you say nodes, do you mean injection points or repeaters or what exactly?
Well, I think that my understanding is those nodes are a combination of injection points and repeaters. You know, that's a word used in the BPL industry that I'm not totally
okay.
understanding of.
I don't want to get too much into the technical part of what they're doing, but do you know how they backhaul the internet out or in and out of Cottonwood?
I believe it comes in on a T1 line.
Okay.
And then, of course, goes down into a node where it's converted to radio frequency energy and then gets on the low voltage and medium voltage power lines.
Okay, so it's that conversion to RF frequency, that radio frequency, that is responsible for what we're going to be talking about now, the radio interference with amateur radio operators.
That's correct.
And what kind of... did you have an understanding with them before they turned it on about the levels of interference that might be created and what procedures might be in place for dealing with it?
Well, I don't think they knew what to expect, nor did we, you know, until it was turned on.
Okay.
Once we knew the location of it, once they let us know it was on the air, then we could go ahead and make our measurements with standard amateur radio equipment.
Okay, and when was it turned on?
I believe that was sometime in early May.
In early May, okay. And then who went out to do what kind of tests?
Well, late May and early June, some of the amateur operators from our radio club went ahead and started using their mobile units to make measurements because there were no fixed station hams located right next to the trial sites at that time.
Okay, so they put it in vans and drove over, put it in their cars? Or
a lot of them just normally have that equipment installed in their car, and they have had for years.
Okay, and what were the findings of those first tests that were done in May?
The first test, that measurements that we made in May, demonstrated that the signals were very, very strong on the amateur bands.
Okay, and what did you do administratively to deal with that?
Well, at that point, I had to leave for the month of June to go back to my office in Detroit. Some of the other hams in the club began to file letter complaints to the FCC and to Electric Broadband, and copies to APS and Mountain Telecommunications Incorporated, you know, expressing their concerns and recording the levels that they heard. So we began to make them aware of it.
Okay, now that's within the context of, this was before the October regulations came out from the FCC, I guess.
Oh, that's, yeah, way before the report and order was issued by the FCC.
Right. Now, were there standardized procedures in place at that time that your group followed in filing these complaints?
No, we just took, you know, normal signal measurements and showed that the ambient noise level in the area beforehand was very low. Once the BPL signals went on the power lines and began to radiate, we saw quite a difference between the normal ambient RF noise level and what we experienced on our receivers.
So you had taken ambient levels before the system was turned on as for baseline?
That's right. We baselined the Old Town Cottonwood area, and because we thought it would be in Old Town, but it turned out to be in another area, Cottonwood. But the whole Cottonwood area, being non-industrial, mostly a bedroom community with a lot of underground power lines and partial overhead power lines, has a very, very low ambient noise level.
Okay. And what was the reaction from MTI, APS, Electric Broadband, EB, and the FCC to your filing of complaints?
Well, the FCC notified Electric Broadband and asked them to work with the amateurs here in the Cottonwood area to try and mitigate or resolve the interference.
And did they?
Over time, they have moved in that direction. We were out yesterday measuring, and it's not completely cleaned up, but they have made progress.
So are you hopeful that they can make enough progress that there won't be any problems there at all?
Well, my concern, Mark, is that statistically, we feel that the trial area, first of all, the representative samples in those nodes in the trial area are too small, and the trial area geographically is too small to statistically show any significant results. And what happens is every time you go to a new node, you have to shift to another 6 megahertz segment or portions of a 6 megahertz segment to send data down the power line. What we're concerned about is that when it rolls out over a wider geographic area, will they be able to mitigate all of those different segments?
Okay, we're going to
where you run into an area, let's say where I live here, there's like 7 amateur operators within 1 mile.
Let's try to focus, before we sort of broaden out the picture, on the physics of it, or the engineering of it. What is it about broadband over power line operations that generates the interference that's experienced by amateur radio operators and other users of that part of the spectrum?
Well, the power lines are an unbalanced transmission line, and they're conducting the BPL carrier signals along that line. Well, in the process, the byproduct of that, since they're using the high-frequency spectrum, these signals are actually radiating off the line. In fact, I'm a mile and a half from the site, and today on a low VHF around 34 megahertz, I could hear bits and pieces of the BPL carriers a mile and a half away from the power lines.
Essentially, the power lines are operating as antennas.
Yes, they're operating as antennas, and that's a real concern of us. Of course, during a high sunspot cycle on certain frequencies, for example, the 10-meter band, if the whole city of Cottonwood was up on BPL and certain segments were transmitting, for example, on 28 or 29 megahertz, would they be able to propagate beyond the Cottonwood area? And that's an unknown to us at this point because the trial is so small.
Okay.
But it is a concern. You know, we're aware of it and concerned about it.
Okay. Now, is it possible for the BPL operators to operate at specific frequencies that don't interfere with specific frequencies used by the ham radio operators? Is that physically impossible, or is it administratively very complicated? Or what?
Well, it's physically possible. The question is, when you start rolling out over a larger area and you're using all these different HF segments, beyond the ham operators, you have low VHF public safety, you have international shortwave broadcast, you have citizen band, you have government frequencies, many, many users in the HF spectrum. So how you avoid all those and still mitigate or notch out the amateur spectrum is a remaining question.
Now, notch out means what exactly?
Well, in some cases, notching out means to suppress the carrier down to where it is at such a low signal level that it does not cause any harmful interference. The other term that they have used with us is padding or changing the frequency, not using that frequency segment completely. You know, that term covers a lot of different concepts when it comes to filtering out interference.
Right. Now, so how complicated is it then for the BPL operator to send out a signal in at various frequencies and then collect the data about what and whom is being interfered with at what frequency, and then reconfigure the BPL operation not to use the frequencies at which it's interfering with the other users? Is that the gist of the process?
Well, I think the process would be on a complaint-by-complaint basis, you know, as a person would notify their local utility or the broadband provider, you know, letting them know that they have an interference problem. Then I think they'd have to go on a case-by-case basis
okay.
to address that issue.
Right. Now, on the case-by-case basis, does each ham radio operator operate on a given a particular frequency or a range of frequencies, and is it an option for them to change the frequency that they're operating at?
They have a range of bands that they can use.
Right.
However, you know, since we are licensed under Part 15 to use those bands, at any time an amateur may choose, you know, to use one band or another, you know, based on his interest or the distance he wants to propagate the signal. If he wants to talk to Europe, you know, or perhaps Ohio or someplace closer into Arizona, he may pick a certain frequency, and that would be just entirely his choice as to how he operates, at what time, and what frequency he uses.
And those different frequencies allow the ham radio operators to reach Ohio or Europe or wherever, depending on various other factors, but it's the modulation of the frequency by the ham radio operators that determines where they're going to be communicating with.
Well, it's not the modulation scheme. It's the choice that they make to use a particular band
of
frequencies that have been licensed to them by the FCC.
Allocated
to them by the FCC.
Okay, and if there are several ham radio operators in one neighborhood, do they all have the right to use the same frequencies, or are they all each given different frequencies to use?
No, they all have the same rights based on the class of license that they might have.
Might they interfere with each other?
Well, generally they would get on different frequencies, discrete frequencies, even on the same band if they were going to operate. You know, two strong stations close to each other, that could be an issue, but generally, you know, that's worked out. But it's like, you know, good neighbor agreement.
Right. And what opportunities do those people have to communicate? How do they communicate with each other to arrange for that?
That's rarely been a problem. There's seven hams within a mile of me here.
Right.
I don't think in 10 years I've ever heard one of them on the air.
Okay.
You know, it's like anything else. You know, when do you turn your computer on to use it, or when do you make a telephone call?
Right.
That's entirely your choice.
Okay. What about the problem caused by the radio frequencies generated by the ham radio operators affecting BPL transmissions?
That's something we've talked to the provider about, and we have an interest in doing RF susceptibility testing, and they said that in the first quarter of next year they would like to go ahead and run those tests. We have looked at reports from other cities around the country, like Rochester, Minnesota, and it looks like BPL is very, very susceptible to RF from those reports that we looked at, but we have not done any testing here ourselves.
Okay, so the general problem there is that it's a two-way street, and the functionality of the BPL could be compromised by the operation of the licensed ham radio operators.
We believe the throughput could be degraded, yes.
Okay. We'll talk now a little bit about the other users besides ham radio operators who are involved in this. In particular, you sent a letter to the Arizona Public Service Company on November 29th. Something that people can get to from the club's site, the association's site, which we're going to link to from this page. Review what you've said here about some of the government operations in and around New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and what the relationship between them and BPL interference is.
Right. Well, the NTIA has asked the...
That's the National Telecommunications and Information Agency?
That's right.
Okay.
Has asked the providers to maintain avoidance of 13 HF government spectrums that they have to notch out on any newly installed equipment. And the question we posed to the provider in areas like the Southwest, where you have a lot of HF federal bands, you know, that are being used by the government that are running high power, you know, there is a concern there. Even though that government portion may be notched out, if a government transmitter is running high power, that may create susceptibility problems to the BPL signals. And that's something that's not been tested.
Okay. Either by the APS, the federal government, or by your group?
That's right.
Okay. What about international shortwave broadcasts? Give us some numbers, if you can, for Arizona, the number of people who are ham radio operators and the number of people who just like to listen to shortwave broadcasts and how that fits in. And apparently Citizens Band Radio is still going on, and how does that fit into this?
Okay, Mark. Well, you know, in Arizona, we looked up that database, and there's approximately 16,000 licensed amateurs. And we're just estimating, based on a reading that I've done, that there's probably 10 to 20 million shortwave listeners nationwide. You know, and some of the popular shortwave frequencies, of course, would be affected by BPL. I don't have good numbers on the number of citizen band operators, since they are not individually licensed. The service is licensed, so I'd probably estimate maybe there's 2, 3, 4 million CB operators nationwide.
Okay.
I think you'd have to proportion that, you know, based on population of each state.
Okay. Now, these are different demographic groups: shortwave broadcast listeners, CB operators, ham radio operators. Could you address the issue that's sometimes put forward by strong proponents of BPL and people who essentially are arguing for ignoring this interference problem, who say that ham radios are an antique technology and people ought to get over it?
Well, amateur radio, of course, has been around for a long time, and it represents a way to communicate worldwide without an infrastructure. The broadband internet, which is wonderful, I use it myself, is a very complicated and technical infrastructure that has to be supported by a lot of other services, whereas a ham operator can take a transmitter, a small antenna, and be talking to some ham thousands of miles away without that infrastructure.
And that comes in handy. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a simple way to communicate, and it's a wonderful backup system during emergencies. For example, the Mexico City earthquake in 1985. I was living in Detroit, Michigan at the time, and I spent 2.5 weeks handling emergency traffic for various agencies in Mexico City when there was no communication out of Mexico City for 7.5 to 8 million people.
So in general, the dynamic is that if BPL is allowed to interfere with the operation of amateur radio operators on a widespread basis, and there's no mitigation provided, they'll just get out of the business, and the infrastructure of amateur radio operations will atrophy, and an important capability for emergency communications will be lost. Is that the scenario?
That's correct. I mean, we don't know the full impact of what would occur, you know, during emergency times, you know, whether it be natural disaster. In some cases, they use VHF frequencies, so they would be out of the range of BPL. In other cases, they use HF frequencies.
Okay. So that means that something has to be done, and I'd like to get your view on what you think, going forward, the approach to resolving this issue ought to be.
Well, I think the resolution ultimately perhaps lies in the application of other technologies like WiMAX and other things that may be coming down the pike.
Do WiMAX and Wi-Fi interfere with ham radio operations?
Not really, because they would be in UHF, SHF frequencies and would not be an issue.
Okay. One point that you make in your letter is that the test here is for a very small part of one town in Arizona, and that the attention that's being given to resolving these issues is rather time-consuming and expensive. And to do that for the entire state of Arizona, should this system be rolled out more broadly, would tax the operations kind of heavily. What do you want to say about that?
I think that's something that the provider, whether it be the wholesaler or the service provider or the consultant, would have to take into consideration in their cost model before they would ever roll something like this out over a large area.
Okay. So what are you and your group doing now going forward to stay on top of the situation?
Well, as you know, just recently when the experimental license for electric broadband was reissued, one of the special conditions on that license was that the Verde Valley Amateur Radio Association, that electric broadband must establish and maintain a liaison relationship with the Verde Valley Amateur Radio Association. And the commission also required electric broadband to respond to interference complaints in a timely manner. And that, to my knowledge, is the first time I have ever seen an experimental commercial license have as a special condition a relationship with an amateur radio club, and I think that sends a signal that there's a problem here and it needs to be looked at very closely.
Has Electric Broadband lived up to those requirements?
Yes, they've been in touch with us. They called us here, Mountain Telecommunications called us here a week or so ago and said they were coming up in the area to make adjustments. So they've done a good job of maintaining contact with us.
So are you hopeful that they will be able to make enough technical adjustments to solve the problem for your area?
Well, as far as the ham bands go, we still have interference on 60 meters right now, so that has not totally been mitigated.
So you've
but like I said before, let's say they do mitigate it off all the ham bands here.
Right.
The trial area, statistically, the geography of it is too small, and the representative sample is too small to have significant information generated from this test.
So if even if they are able to resolve the ham radio interference issues in that particular test area, there's no assurance that they'll be able to do it statewide.
Well, I think if they were to roll out over a larger area where they ran into a larger population of hams or, you know, shortwave listeners or CB operators or whoever might be using that HF spectrum, there, you know, the number of complaints generated may rise dramatically, and they'll have to address those on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. I think any last things you want to say that you haven't been able to?
Well, you know, it's been for us, quite a interesting year for our radio club that's been basically here in Sleepy Hollow. You know, we've gotten a real wake-up call, and we've hoped that we've helped generate information for the Federal Communications Commission, you know, so that they could make the proper judgment call when it comes to this report and order. And it remains to be seen, you know, when this rolls out over a wide area, just what's really going to happen.
Okay. Well, maybe we can check back with you then and see what is happening. And thank you very much for talking to us today on Broadband Over Powerline World.
Okay, that was great, Mark, and we'd be glad to talk to you again. And thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye.
Okay, bye, Mark.